Blog Talk Radio.
Buckle up and get ready to ride this cosmic wave of knowledge. Talk Radio. It's time to reach beyond the limitations of your mind. A time to travel where the impossible is now possible. As we travel around the world in search of the truth. And now, author, international clairvoyant, and Earth Mysteries investigator, Betsy Lewis.
Welcome to Stargate Radio. I bet you remember that music from Tubular Bells. It was from The Exorcist and Exorcist movie in 1973. So what does The Exorcist have to do with my guest, my friend and best-selling author Ron Felber, who joins us tonight? A lot. They have a big connection, and we're going to hear about that in just a couple of minutes. Ron brought us the true story of alien abduction with Mojave Incident, and now he brings us the chilling novel, The Unwelcomed, based on a true story of demonic possession, available, I believe, on Amazon May 30th. Ron was given this true story by William Peter Blatty, my step-uncle, while he filmed The Exorcist in 1972 at Georgetown University. So Ron is a graduate of Georgetown University, Loyola University, and Drew University, where he earned his doctorate. Some of his books have made their way to film and television, including The Mojave Incident, An Editore, The Double Life of a Mafia Doctor, and The Hunt for Hunsay. And Ron also teaches creative writing, at Drew University. So let me bring him on. Ron, are you there?
I'm there, Betsy. Good to hear from you. It's always nice to talk to you.
Well, great to have you on the show tonight.
I just want to mention one thing, if I might. The Unwelcomed is available for pre-order right now on Amazon Barnes & Noble. So people can order it if they choose to, and I certainly hope they choose to.
Oh, they will, I'm sure. No doubt. I see people already ordering on there, so you won't have any problem with that. I loved the novel. It's really chilling. And it's based on fact. And I think with Bill's novel, it was somewhat true. It was based on a boy that was possessed, and he turned it into a little girl. You know, the rest is, you know, mm-hmm. creative mm-hmm. writing. But yours is really based mostly on fact, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, thanks to Bill Blatty, who I'm indebted to for this, and just being a great friend, he directed me to the Harvard Medical School Library, where the case history of Clara Fowler resided. It was archived there. And gave me the name of the curator, called the curator, and so I was able to see the documentation for probably the best documented case of demonic possession that maybe ever, because you had William James, the famous Harvard Medical School lecturer and practitioner, who pretty much is the father of abnormal psychology, Dr. Morton Prince from Harvard and Tufts University. You had George Waterman, the heir to the Waterman Penn fortune and also a Harvard Medical School graduate. You had Leonora Piper, who was a clairvoyant at the time, and you had Richard Hoxton, who was the president of the Society for Psychical Researchers. So it was a combination of materialist scientists and spiritualists that form this team.
That's amazing. I've got to tell you something really strange, because I was looking at Clara Fowler, and I came across a Clara Germana, I think it is Sally or something. She lived from 1890 to 1912 in South Africa. Little black girl, I guess, but she was possessed, and she showed all the things, all the paranormal things that were going on with Clara. And I thought, wow, that's kind of strange. And her name was Clara.
You know, I'll tell you, everything is just filled with strange things and coincidences with regard to this book. It's kind of chilling in its own little way, but yeah, it's just loaded with coincidences. And one of the real coincidences is how I got the story. You know, some
yes, tell us about
ago.
It.
well, I was a student at Georgetown, and I wanted to be a writer. You know, I had been writing since the sixth grade and publishing short stories in, you know, the high school magazine and at the Georgetown magazine and such. I had my first novel. So this was like, you know, all of these typos and 300 pages, you know, sort of thrown together like an 18, 17-year-old kid would do. And Bill was filming The Exorcist in Georgetown with Billy Friedkin and company, and I wanted to meet him. And I figured, you know, here's a guy from New York, sort of inner city of New York. I'm from Newark. He was on scholarship here. I was on scholarship here because he had attended Georgetown, by the way, at Georgetown University. I said, you know, maybe this connection will be such that he says, you know, let me help you with your book or help you with your writing. And at the time, of course, The Exorcist was on the bestsellers list, New York Times bestsellers list for 56 weeks. So I couldn't meet him directly at the time because, you know, he was busy filming. But I heard that he had an office across the Potomac, across the Key Bridge at the Key Bridge Marriott. So I went there with my manuscript. And I met an administrative assistant that was helping out with everything. And I said, you know, would you please give this to William Peter Blatty? And she said, sure. And there was this pile of books, a mountain of books from Germany, from England, from Spain, from anywhere you would want to mention, 70, 80 manuscripts piled up. I said, no, please. Don't put it in that pile. Would you please give it to him personally? So she said, I don't think I can do that. I said, let me ask you a question. How many people have come into this office with a manuscript and asked you to do that of those 80 manuscripts back there? She said, none. I said, exactly. Exactly.
Wow. Wow.
So she gave it to him. And I guess he liked it enough. So he gave me a call at my home. I was back for Thanksgiving vacation, and it was a great Thanksgiving treat. Because he said, I like your book. I remember this so vividly. I read every word of it. And you have the brains and the talent to be a fine novelist. So I said, well, that's pretty good. So we met. He didn't help me with that book because, you know, it was a adolescent sort of book. But he did help me with the next. And more than anything, he passed along the idea, the story, of The Unwelcomed, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler, where I could research it. He called ahead to the library so they would let me look at the files and whatnot. And, you know, that's how this book came about.
That's incredible. Excuse me. Hold on just a minute here. That's amazing. So I do have a little surprise for you. And I, you know who Julie Blatty is, don't you?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I spoke to her, and I told her about your book and that you dedicated it to Bill Blatty and her husband. She's a widow now. He passed away in 2017. But yeah. She was going to come on the show, but she had a prior engagement. But she said she wishes you great success, and she's pulling for you. And when I told her about the dedication, she said, wow, how lovely. Please thank him for me.
That's so sweet. And you know, it's funny how people – and, you know, I teach. And so I teach writing now at the Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. I do it online. And for graduate students, but it's just amazing how some people affect your life, you know, in a really profound way. And Bill was one of those people in my life, so that means a lot.
So I heard you went to Malibu to meet with him. When was that? What year was that?
Oh, God, that's really tough. I'm not so good with years, but I would say it was something like 75, 76.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe it was around 72, 73 or something there.
No, it was a little later because what happened was he gave me the story, and I tried to write it. And, frankly, it's a difficult story to write because it happens from 1898 to 1904. And so Sigmund Freud is part of the story. You know, of course, mm-hmm. William James. It's very difficult to write in other times. I was writing spy novels and things like that, which took place currently. And that's much easier than reaching back 120 years and saying, like, you know, what cigarettes did people smoke then? How did they speak? You know, how would William James talk? Where were cars at the time? How, you know, were there a lot of automobiles in 1900 on the streets of Back Bay, Boston, things like that. And it was a little too much for me. So I did go to Malibu, and I did meet with him. And actually, you're right. Actually, the trip to Malibu was right at the Academy Awards, the week of the Academy Awards.
Oh,
so
wow.
I did meet him then. It wasn't for that particular project, but I did meet him then. And it was great because I remember he had a limousine, so he dropped me off at my hotel. I stayed with him for a couple of days, and it was just great. Like I said, it's such a nice thing for a young person that's aspiring to do something, like be a writer, let's say, which is
nice.
And then to meet a guy that's really a successful writer that really takes the time, just hours, talking to you about your work, about, you know, progress, how you do this, how you do that, how he did this, how he did that. And so that was great. But the real story, Betsy, the real story is this. When I delivered a second manuscript, which he did help me get published, I went to the Beverly Hills Hotel originally. And he had moved out of the Beverly Hills Hotel where I was supposed to be meeting him to Sherman Oaks, which is quite a distance from Beverly Hills. So I came, and I had no money. I was a deputy sheriff at the time, and I had my manuscript, which wound up getting published, and I was wearing this suit. So stupid as I was, I was wearing the suit because I wanted to be dressed well. And it was like 98 degrees in Los Angeles.
I get to
the Beverly Hills Hotel, and the saddest person in the world must have been me when the manager said, oh, he checked out. I said, what? I had $80 in my pocket.
And
in those days, credit cards were not so – so I had $80. I said, look, man, you don't understand. I came all the way from Arlington, Virginia. And, I don't have much money. I have this manuscript. I told him the whole story. He said, look, I never told you this, right? I said, okay. He said, there's an address for an emergency. And so this is the address, but I didn't give it to you. So I said, okay. So I take a cab, and it goes all through the mountains and whatnot. And I get there, and the fare is probably 75 of my $80. I show up to this door, and I knock on it, and Tippi Hedren from The Birds, the actress that starred in The Birds, answers. Opens the door. So she goes, who are you? She goes, who are you? And there's this sweating guy in a suit, in this winter suit, in 98 degrees outside her door with a desperate look in his eye. And she goes, I told her the whole story about Blatty and whatnot. Says, well, he's out with my husband, Noel Marshall, who was the producer of The Exorcist, and you can come on in and wait, which was really, really nice of her. So I get inside, and she collected, and I know this sounds crazy, but it's true, lions. She had lions, like 40 lions.
Yeah.
So I sit down on the couch, and I'm, like overwhelmed with heat and whatnot, and just, I guess, nerves, stress. And I see this stuffed animal on the side. She's there in a chair on a couch. And at the corner of the couch is a stuffed animal. And the stuffed animal starts to move. It starts to walk around. I go, you know, Tippy, it's been a long day, and maybe I have heat prostration or something like that. But did that stuffed animal just walk around? She goes, oh, that's not a stuffed animal. That's my lion cub. I said, oh, isn't that nice? What I didn't realize was the lion cub had a mother. And that other big lion starts like a cat rubbing against my leg. This maybe 200-pound lion starts rubbing against my leg like a cat might do. And I go, is this dangerous to me? She goes, not if you're nice to me. I said, well, you have no worries about that. I'm nice to everybody. So I said, well, then there's no problem. So they came back. Her daughter, Melanie Griffith. Her daughter was Melanie Griffith, the actress.
Yeah.
And
right.
So all of us went out to, I think, a place called The Hungry Eye and had dinner. And that was my story about getting my second novel to Bill Blatty.
That's amazing. Now, do you know how I'm related to him, how he's my step-uncle?
No. How does that go?
Okay. Well, my mother went to a dating service in Beverly Hills. And my mother at the time, that was in 71. And a guy named Maurice Blatty, which was Bill Blatty's brother, saw her and started dating her. And I guess their first date, he threw the novel at her and said, read this, my brother wrote it. He was quite a character, but they ended up getting married, and that's how I became related to Bill. And Maurice Blatty, or we called him Mo, became my stepfather. So, isn't it a small world?
It is a very, and you know, even the coincidence of us meeting, given these relationships, the whole thing is, it's, I guess it was written in the stars somehow, huh?
It was. Well, there's no coincidences, Ron, as you know. I think things are just meant to be.
More and more I realize that. More and more I realize that destiny set out before us. But
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, please. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, your book cover is just incredible, and it kind of reminds me of The Exorcist. No, but I noticed there is an entity at the end of the road there.
Yeah.
Did you know that? Yeah, okay. I don't think a lot of people have noticed that yet, but that's really a scary-looking entity there.
It's really a great cover, and I have to say the publisher, which is Black Rose Publishing, is out of Texas. And I had another story. You know, this book was supposed to be published by another publisher, a larger publisher, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. And, you know, this with writing and music and whatnot, it's just an acting, I guess. It's just heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. But the publisher, they stopped publishing the imprint, the major house. I mean, Schuster said, well, we're not going to do that anymore. And so I had a contract.
No.
That was worthless, and I really had been waiting a good 9 months for the book to come out, and it just, you know, it just didn't. And so fortunately, there had been about, I think, five publishers had accepted it, which was great, and I took the biggest one because I thought it would be the best, but I guess that wasn't the best decision of my life. So I went back hat in hand to a couple of the other publishers that had accepted it. And I said no 9 months before, and I go, you know, maybe I made a mistake. Do you think you would reconsider looking at this? And thank God, a guy named Reagan Roth from Black Rose said, you know, I love your book, and yeah, sure, we'll do it. And so here we are.
Wow, isn't that something? Yeah, I remember when you were going through all that. I thought, oh no, poor Ron, he's going through all this. But I knew you were going to find one.
But, you know, if you know, I mean, the arts are just filled with triumph and heartbreak, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
when
absolutely.
I was in college, I wrote a book that not related to Bill. This was I had a book published, And they offered me a contract to write the Nick Carter series. This was like the American James Bond. So it's just sort of spy novels. And so this was great for me. You know, I mean, at the time, Ken Follett was writing them. And Martin Cruz Smith, who did Gorky Park, was writing the Nick Carter series. So I said, oh, great. You know, these are pretty successful guys. This is how they started. You know, this would be a good start for me. So I wrote my first of them. And a very similar thing happened. I had a contract, and the publisher went bankrupt. Fortunately, thank God, I then was able to resell it to a different publisher. And as it turned out, it was Ace Books, who was a pretty big publisher at the time. So after the film, picked up the Nick Carter series and picked up my contract. So I wound up writing three of those. But it was the most depressing day of my life. I was 23 years old. I was waiting for a check from the publisher, and my roommate, a guy that I went to school with, was there, and he knew I was waiting for the check. So he took the envelope, and he put it on scotch tape, and he said, congratulations. Well, I opened it expecting a check, and I found this letter saying, you know, it's been like the Titanic here at this publishing house, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been bankrupt.
Wow.
Not exactly. But like I said, and then – There's other times when you're like this, where things just really work out well, and you know, it couldn't be better. That's the art.
That's right.
The art's really a very very much a roller coaster ride.
So why didn't Bill keep that story? It's such an incredible, great story. You'd think after writing The Exorcist, he would have kept that story for himself.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think what he decided to do, I remember this pretty vividly, and I can't say why he turned that over, but he did. And I don't think he understood. You see, I hired a detective to help with the research, and it was more than just, as you know, I mean, this is sort of like a murder mystery. It involves, three murders and some of the characters. For example, this city marshal from Fall River, his name was Bassett Hilliard, and Bassett, like a Bassett town. And Bassett Hilliard was an incredible character. He had investigated the Lizzie Borden axe murders in Fall River. He had also investigated, and this is really strange, another murder that happened 4 months later and just a couple miles away, another axe murder where a farm worker named Corey Arrow killed his boss's wife in her kitchen. But the interesting thing with both Lizzie Fowler, Lizzie Borden, and Corey Arrow was they had no memory of the murder. Matter of fact, Corey Arrow, after he did this vicious, vicious murder, went into town and bought a pair of shoes. Lizzie Borden, just said she had nothing to do with this, and was acquitted. Bassett knew better because there was evidence that he was convinced that, she had done the murders, but he was also convinced she had no memory of it, like Corey Arrow. And that has a lot to do with the story. And I don't think Bill knew about that. What he knew about, because he researched just the exorcist part of the exorcism part of it and the demonic possession part of it. And then I got, because these names are all disguised, they use pseudonyms, Morton Prince in his book left huge sections of important and significant things out. But when I went to the library, I was able to see the real documents, even though the names were crossed out. I then hired a detective to help the real names. And once we got the real names, it was like a treasure trove of information. So for Bill, I think maybe he felt like he covered that base. I understand that they asked Peter Benchley, after he did Jaws, to do Jaws 2. He said, I did the definitive shark movie. And I think maybe Bill thought that he did the definitive exorcist, exorcist book and movie.
Right, right. Well, yeah. And it was incredible. I remember, we thought we were going to have to stand in lines around corners and everything when it first came out. And because Mo, Bill's brother, got us right in, he told the manager of theater who we were, and we got right in. So that was pretty cool.
It rocked the world. It really did.
Yeah, it was. So tell us more about Clara, because What a fascinating person. When did all this start happening? What age was she when all this paranormal stuff started happening?
She was like 21, 22. So she was a student at Radcliffe College in Boston. And very religious, you know, sort of quiet, studious, you know, religious person, woman, young woman. And she started to have nightmares, horrible nightmares. She started to not be able to eat because when she looked at her food, she'd see maggots in it and whatnot. And just, in terms of sleeping, she was so terrified of these dreams, these horrendous dreams of hell and devils and whatnot, that she didn't want to go to sleep. She tried to stay awake so she wouldn't have to go through that. And so when she went to a doctor named Jackson Putnam, who was also a renowned Boston Brahmin, you know, high-level society, he was just more of a general practitioner. And he found out over time that not only was she having nightmares, not only was she having insomnia and lack of appetite, but she would have missing time. She would have time where she didn't know what happened. She'd wake up, for example, walking in the public square and not know how she got there. And then she realized that for whatever reason, she was being worn down. And then she started getting notes like threatening letters, you know, like, you know, when are you going to put a bullet through your head and end all this? The body is mine. This is my body, you know. And
wow.
And so she was harrowed. So Putnam didn't know what to do with it. I mean, he said, well, there's William James and Prince, who are really, you know, the forerunners of psychology, modern-day psychology. These are the guys that she should see. So they did. And Prince tried to hypnotize her to see if there was some trauma in her life that maybe was causing these things. And during the hypnotism, this voice comes out, and it, like an explosion. And it's a man's voice, very, very malevolent, very menacing, very powerful, and says, you know, you think you can control her, can't control me. And so Prince goes, well, you are her. You know, why do you refer to her as she? You are she. You are Clara Fowler. No, I'm not. I'm spirit. I'm the devil. And now they were off and running into a whole different track. And Clara Fowler then, the demon realized that the weaker she was, the more easily it could take control of the body. And oftentimes Prince would see, Prince and the team, this team, would see Clara actually struggling with the demon moment to moment. Her facial features would remold back to Clara, back to the demon. The voices, you know, would change, like a struggle was going on to see who would control the body. And unfortunately, the demon was really winning, and she was on the verge of dying. And they tried some radical things, including exorcism.
It sounded like her father was abusive. I know he was an alcoholic, and he may have had something to do with her, excuse me, her siblings dying at 4 months old, right? Two siblings?
Yeah.
Two
siblings separated by 4 years, died at 4 days old. And the coroner, not the doctor, but the coroner said, this is very suspicious. You know, obviously there were some physical signs that this was not a natural these were not natural deaths. And Bassett, the city marshal, the sort of detective, was convinced it was Clara's father who was an alcoholic and a very violent fellow, a wife beater, and was convinced that that was the murderer. Now, he had solved or been involved with the Lizzie Borden murder, with the Corriero murder. And this was all at the same time within about a 5-mile radius. And then he had the two Clara Fowler, the two Fowler siblings. that he believed were murdered. And this is a town that hadn't had a murder in 50 years, and all of a sudden, within 4 or 5 years, they have two brutal axe murders, the father and mother of Lizzie Borden, the wife of Bertha Manchester, and then the two infants, all within the course of a very, very short period of time in a very small radius. And so he wanted Clara to testify against her father. And so that's, he went to Boston. What does he find? That Clara Fowler is under the care of Dr. Morton Prince for what is assumedly demonic possession. Although Prince did not believe in that, he believed in that there were paranormal things that the brain was capable of, and he was well aware of those. But William James and certainly Richard Hugson, you know, said very clearly, look, you know, you have a woman who's been brought to the brink of destruction. You know, she talks in other voices. She speaks in other languages. She's clairvoyant. She goes crazy whenever, you know, they're violently crazy, whenever there are religious objects or religious people involved. Mm-hmm. These are all the classic signs of demonic possession. You know, if it walks like a duck, it, you know, waddles like a duck, et cetera,
right.
It must be a duck.
Occam's razor, right?
Yeah. So that's the basis of it. But the really interesting thing I think about this book is it's an argument, really, where you have Prince, who was a colleague, you know, a contemporary, let's call it, of Sigmund Freud. Mm-hmm. Freud didn't like Prince, and Prince didn't like Freud. Prince said that psychoanalysis was rubbish. He was a behavioralist. And by the way, I mean, between the two, probably the view that holds would be Prince's, but he never got the recognition, although he wanted it, that Sigmund Freud got. His feeling was that if you have a schizophrenic, if you had multiple personality, if you had these kind of things, generally it was about an imbalance, a chemical imbalance in the brain,
mm-hmm.
or a lesion
mm-hmm.
in the brain, that there was a physical thing. So, for example, if you have an ulcer, it's a psychological thing, stress, but you have a physical
right.
reaction, which is the ulcer. He believed these things were connected, that there was a physiological reason for most of these illnesses, psychological illnesses. And so Prince had published in 1901 Interpretations of a Dream, which set in motion the push, this huge push towards psychoanalysis. And Prince thought this case, if he could prove that what had been called demonic possession for thousands of years was really a psychological affliction caused by something, you know, maybe a catastrophic trauma or a lesion in the brain or something along those lines,
mm-hmm.
if he could
sure.
solve the mystery of demonic possession, he would overshadow Prince, and psychiatry would take a behavioralist position going into the future.
Well, you know, last Thursday, I had a guest on. She's a psychologist. Her name is Dr. Ponch Lopez, and she teaches at Nevada State University, and she talked about multiple personality disorder or dissociative disorders,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
I asked her, I said, do you believe that demons are involved in, you know, possession? And she said, absolutely. I mean, she was amazing. She blew me away.
Well, you know, more and more, I mean, even physicists, you know, you talk about, you know, quantum mechanics and quantum physics, et cetera. You know, everything changes. And when you come right down to it, even the honest scientists hit a brick wall, and they'll tell you that. You know, Aristotle called it the unmoved mover. So, for example, if you see a set of dominoes that goes a mile long, and you're at the end and you see the last domino fall, you say, this is amazing. You know, for miles and miles, these dominoes have fallen. But somebody then asked, well, who pushed the first domino? Who is the unmoved mover? And that's where
right.
scientists hit an absolute brick wall. And people like Hoffman, who wrote The Case Against Reality, you know, they say, you know, we have no idea what reality really is. And in my view, that probably 95%, maybe 98% of life is non-physical, of existence is non-physical.
Right. Now, were you raised Catholic?
I was.
I guess so, because you went to Georgetown University, but I had that feeling. So I know there's so much in the Catholic, you know, faith that probably believe in some of these things, you know, exorcisms, and even though priests do exorcisms still, right?
More and more. As a matter of fact, the Pope, I think it was maybe 7 years ago or so, formed a sort of little army of exorcists, and there were only a handful of exorcists maybe 20 years ago, but there's about 150 recognized by the papacy exorcists in the United States, because the number of exorcisms has gone up significantly over the last 20 years or so.
Wow. Wow. Well, I think there's a lot more evil in the world. It's getting worse. I don't know where these people are coming from, but, you know. Now, what do you think, aliens or demons? Maybe aliens are responsible for some of these people being possessed. What do you think?
Well, you know, another switch has happened, and I think this guy Grush or whatever, he was a lieutenant commander in the Navy, air pilot, and he talks about interdimensional beings. He doesn't call them aliens.
Mm-hmm.
He calls them interdimensional beings. And as you know, I wrote a book called Mojave Incident that dealt in great detail with alien abduction.
Sure.
And there are real comparisons, and I'll give you a couple. One, both the alien abduction couple, the Hesses, talked about this this overriding, this overwhelming odor of sulfur or phosphorus. Well, the same happens with Clara Fowler. She can tell when the demonic presence is going to be showing itself by the smell of sulfur and phosphorus. You have, in the case of the Mojave incident, what they call these gremlins, you know, these beings that frenetic, chaotic, you know, malevolent creatures that they encounter, and they're demonic. Well, Clara, in her nightmares and in her conscious awareness, talks about exactly that, like these sort of gremlin beings that hang on the bedposts of her bed at night, staring at her. And so that's another thing. But the one that really clinches it for me, ties these together, and I'm not quite sure how, is the idea of an angelic presence. Now, for Clara, she had had visitations from the Virgin Mary, and this was a regular thing that was documented over time, you know, that she had had regular visitations who comfort her through this trauma of demonic possession. By the same token, the Hesses, in their worst moments, during the alien abduction, when they were being tormented, an angelic presence, they called it clearly feminine, angelic in the classical sense, you know, came from the clouds and comforted them. You know, don't worry, you will survive this, your children will be okay. And so whether you like it or you don't, there is a kind of, whether you want to call it a Virgin Mary, whether you want to call it an angel, whether you want to call it an angelic presence, whatever, whether you want to call it a demon, whether you want to call it a gremlin, whether you want to call the smell sulfur or whether you want to call the smell phosphorus, you know, these are just labels. But at the end of the day, there are real and true parallels between these phenomena. And how they relate, I'm not quite sure, except to say that I think in both cases that there is more of a spiritual angle to it than even a physical one.
Exactly. I heard you on a talk show talk about the Fantoma in 1913, the three children that saw the Marian vision for 6 months. And it was so strange that they, you know, saw her at a certain time, solar noon, on the 13th day of the month. I did a lot of research on it. And I know you mentioned aliens. You know, I thought the same thing, you know, when the earth, you know, when the children were out there, it was raining, and all of a sudden the sun came out and started spinning. It sounded like a UFO because they all said it looked like it was silvery and didn't even look like the sun, right? It sounded like a mothership.
and as a matter of fact, you know, in the Bible, Elijah talks about fiery chariot, et cetera. So I think that Grush was onto something when he talked about interdimensional beings. But at the base of it, I think that, and I think Bill would agree with this, Bill Blatty would agree with this, I think that that human, in a very classical sense, human beings are sort of in the middle between two very powerful forces. One is evil. It leans towards chaos and blood and murder and war. And the other is goodness. And that would be unity and peace and harmony. And I think human beings are pulled in either direction, and in some cases, and actually there's a quote that's very powerful about this, if I may. Can I read it?
Sure, go ahead, please.
Yeah. This is the demon talking. He goes, "The prince, another secret. Most are borderline, but occasionally we come upon a special case. Borden, Holmes, the Ripper, countless others whose names you will never know, and these by their own choosing become me, evil incarnate, prowling the earth with one purpose, to reduce God's so-called creations to the brutish animals I know them to be." And I think in a lot of ways that is the nature of evil, but it's also the nature of goodness. So as much as we can talk about a Jack the Ripper, we can also talk about a Mother Teresa. And as much as we can talk about, you know, somebody that's a hitman for the mafia, we can also talk about somebody that is a soldier who jumped on a hand grenade to save, you know, 20 members of his platoon.
Interesting.
Yeah, wow.
You know, I've interviewed Bob Luca and his wife, Betty Andreas and Luca, and Bob was told that evil must exist on this plane so that we learn, you know, we learn from the darkness, because if everything was perfect, how would we learn, you know, or grow spiritually?
Yes. No, I think that's true. And I think there's certainly an element of evil in all of us. And I think there's certainly the temptation for evil in all of us. And I think at the end, at some point in time, maybe a lot of people play in the middle and are just regular guys and regular women. But there are exceptions, and the exceptions, I think, surrender to one or the other. And in the end, I think everybody has to make a choice. Which side of this line are you on? And I think most people opt for goodness, but the ones that don't, that really don't, that buy into this, you know, lock, stock, and barrel, I think actually become a demonic presence, and that's the nature of demonic possession.
I've seen too many people that are alcoholics become demonic and scary personality changes. So I think there is some demonic possession when people do drink. You know, they lower their vibrational rate and allows these entities to come through.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I transported federal prisoners for a number of years.
Oh, that's
when I first got out of school. And, you know, I met some characters. I, you know, don't want to go into detail. But, you know, people that really, you know, were animalistic, what can I say, worse than animals, because at least animals just do it for food or whatever. But these people killed and hurt people for fun. And that's another, it's a whole other realm, you know.
Wow, how scary. You know,
it
with Bill Blatty, Yeah, it really is scary. You know, I was thinking that, you know, Bill Blatty, when they were filming The Exorcist, had a lot of weird things going on, a lot of paranormal things, you know, that there was a fire on the set, and I think people died, you know, mysteriously, it seemed like, or suddenly, anyway. Have you had anything happen, what they call the hitchhiker effect?
Yeah, well, you know, I hesitate to mention this, but actually, just this morning, my wife woke up and told me about a shadow she saw creeping around. A shadow she saw creeping around the room, and I said, well, you know, lights and the moon. And,
right. You tried to reassure her it wasn't.
It's a preferable explanation, right?
Well, I've had
some
weird
things
happen.
Like, I have to tell you, honestly, just recently we have a garage door, and the garage door has a like a code, you know, a little box inside.
Right, we have that.
It opens the garage door.
Yeah.
Well, this lock's pretty good. I mean, it's plastic. You push it down, and it catches. And I would say one time out of four when we come home recently, it's open. The thing is flipped open. And the wind couldn't do it. The wind could not do it. It's clipped. So I've had a couple of odd experiences recently.
You know what I think it is?
What?
It's your mom. I know your mom passed away. I think your mom is showing you that she's there watching over you.
Well, you know, the other thing about that, which is interesting, of course, I miss my mother a lot, like you'd imagine, but, and so does Ingrid. And so does her little granddaughter. Her little granddaughter is six, and she only knew my mother a short while, the granddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll just look at you and say, you know, I miss Miss Florence. That's what she called her. But we have some of her furniture. So there's a particular room where we have some of the furniture from her apartment. And, you know, it just has this wonderful scent. Just this wonderful scent when you walk in, which is different from any other place in the house. So I don't discount what you're saying at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I just got that sense. I mean, I got chills when you said that. But, yeah, I feel that is your mom. And you have nothing to worry about. She's right there.
I think that's a great approach. I think you're probably right. You know, I have something between Hodgson, who's the spiritualist, and Prince. This basic argument about whether this is scientific, you know, or materialist, or whether it's spiritual. Could I read a little bit of that?
Yes, please.
Okay.
We have time.
Prince turns to Hodgson. He goes, throughout the ages, this is the doctor now, right, the scientist. Throughout the ages, diseases of the mind have been falsely labeled demonic possession by those who would have us believe supernatural entities creep into the natural world, ghosts, witches, devils. Have we learned nothing from the work of Charcot on the pathology of hysteria and epilepsy? Think for a moment about the poor souls subjected to unspeakable tortures, women burned at the stake here in Massachusetts, no less, in the name of religion and belief in evil incarnate, when, as Tourette proved, the symptoms associated with Tourette syndrome have nothing to do with demons and everything to do with a chemical imbalance in the brain. Now Hodgson, the spiritualist. Listen, please. We have a set of symptoms manifested by a second consciousness. As proved by you, it takes possession of Miss Fowler's body, claiming to be spirit, despises her, threatens her, and has driven her to the brink of destruction. Given these facts, one can label her disorder anything one chooses, but a name doesn't explain a phenomenon that's existed in a corner of the world for thousands of years. Gregory of Tours, who reported the possession of a young girl who took on not only the voice but the appearance of a Persian man who died decades before. The 17th century case of Elizabeth Knapp, who read her exorcist thoughts, predicting future events through messages spontaneously erupting on her body. And today, the anthropologist Junot's account of a possessed woman in Africa who vanished from her home one night and was found the following morning on top of a tall tree, after which she glided down, head first, flicking her tongue in and out like a snake. She hung suspended for a time and began to speak in a language later identified as Aramaic. How do you account for these? Now, Prince. Anecdotes. That's what you're putting forward, Hobson. Where are the doctors? Where are the clinicians, scientists who would document these stories? Without that, we have what we always have in spiritualist arguments: hearsay, fraud, misunderstood symptoms leading to misdiagnosis and mythology. To that I say, angels, ghosts, hobgoblins, show me your face. Hobson stepped up to him pleading. Don't you see, Morton? Can you not bring yourself to understand the great mystery we stand on the threshold of solving? I beg you, consider at least the possibility that here at last in the city of Boston, 1898, is tangible evidence of transcendence. If there are demons, there must be angels, and probably a God and a life everlasting. You ask me where are the doctors and clinicians. Dr. Prince, we are the doctors. We are the clinicians.
Wow. Beautiful.
It is the argument. It is the argument that goes on today, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, Ron, and just a great book. I want to tell everybody, you know, when it comes out, you can pre-order it right now on Amazon. And it's coming out, what, May 30th? Is that right?
Yes, it'll be
available.
It'll be shipped and distributed then, but you can order it now, The Unwelcomed, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler.
And your website?
Just an easy one, ronfelber.com. F-E-L-B-E-R.
Great. Great, Ron. Incredible interview. Thank you so much. I know we've had a connection for a long time when that book fell off my bookshelf, you know, that was your first book. It was called The Searchers, which became the Mojave Incident. So there's no coincidences, right?
Yeah, no, that is, it's really remarkable. And I'm delighted that book fell off your bookshelf.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling that Bill's watching over you right now, and he's had a little something to do to help things, move things around. Because it took you, 2 years to write this?
More than that. You know, you have to remember, I tried to write this 50 years ago, so I had all
right.
The research. So if you're asking me, this is a book that's 50 years in the making.
Well, why did it take you so long?
I didn't have the talent to do it.
Well, that's,
you know,
true.
Really,
yeah.
You know, it took a while to just develop the skill level to tackle a
sure.
task like this. And I did it, but it just didn't come out well. But I redid the whole thing. I said, let me throw that manuscript out and let's start anew. And
fortunately,
it came out just fine.
You had a little help, didn't you, with research?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, the ability, I could never have done this without the ability to go into the Harvard Medical School Library and have access to the archived records.
Well, it's great. And I know, I see it as a movie. I know it's going to be a movie. I predict, and my predictions come true a lot of the time.
I'm
Ron,
sure they
so
do.
Get ready.
Sure they...
You're going to be really busy. This is your year.
I hope so. Well, what a delight
yeah,
it is to talk to you.
Well, you too. And we'll stay in touch. We've been in touch since, 2013? So.
Yes.
We go way back, don't we?
We go way back. Well, anyway, it's been great. And it's not, like I said, it's always a delight to talk to you.
You too. Thanks so much, Ron. Take care.
Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. You take care as well.
Bye-bye.